So this is the Center for the Study of Religion and the City, COVID-19 Relief and Restoration Oral History Project. This is Abel Gomez with Ariel Mejia with Rihanna Lloyd of Jews United for Justice. And today is October 27th, 2020. So before we dive into the questions, I thought I would just offer some review from our last session. Here I am with lecturer mode review. So when we talked last time, we spoke a bit about the organization in general, and we spent some time talking about Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and the work of Jews engaged in social justice struggles. We talked about redlining and working for housing justice. And different issues that renters are having. So one of the things we talked about, for example, was around water, and that apparently landlords are using that as kind of a weapon to get more money from renters. We also talked about work that is being done in terms of passing bills and workshops around educating folks around defunding the police. As well as how the organization is maintaining a sense of community in the wake of social distancing. So with that, just to start with, I'm wondering if you could speak a bit about how folks in the organization have observed any kind of cultural or religious celebrations in the wake of social distancing.
That's a great question. So, yeah. So I think that in all of the ways that COVID and everything else that is happening has been really restricting and really limiting, I think it's also allowed for a lot of people to be creative in how they can celebrate, how they can commemorate different events and spend what does it mean to spend time together. So we did have earlier in the summer, so I think it was like beginning of August, was the Jewish holiday of Tisha B'Av, which is like a national day of mourning. And basically it's around the destruction of these temples back in, historic times. And it's generally like a day of like sitting with sadness, to sort of like distill it. We last year organized with lots of other congregations and organizations, a demonstration where folks risked arrest in front of the Howard County Detention Center around, and like with the framing of Tisha B'Av and sort of like with mourning and like leading to collective action. And so this year there was definitely a precedent to do something similar, but we were in the midst of a pandemic. We, although really not me, like all of my other colleagues and leaders really took the lead on creating another event that was socially distant. So around the state, there was one in like Baltimore City, one in Howard County. It was small groups, like people of 10 or so, spread out, sort of like leading in prayer and like moving to action. So in Baltimore City, it was around police accountability. In Howard County, it was the detention center and collaboration with ICE. And actually, Tisha B'Av, you are supposed to be like not really gathering. You're supposed to be kind of like not interacting with people. And so in some ways it actually embodied the spirit of the holiday even more. So that's one example. And we just had all of our high holidays. So Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, Yom Kippur, when you atone for your sins and fast for the day. Similarly, it's a time that you're often with family, with community members. And so again, it was seeing a lot of online services and different ways to kind of like bring the holiday, you know, to yourself. So if you can't go to synagogue, if you can't be with your family, like what is it about the holiday that is meaningful for you? And what are the different ways that, that we can connect? Cause I think a lot of it is just, we're already in that mindset. So we can sort of utilize that, that mindset to, you know, share some things with our community members and realize that our community is bigger than just, you know, the people who sit next to you at synagogue or your local friends and families, that it's like a bigger community.
And then these online platforms like Zoom allow you to access people who are not in your immediate geographical area to also participate in these celebrations.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that was also nice. And we had a, you know, I know we've been talking about housing. We had a renter's right to counsel panel earlier in October, and that was like right around Sukkot, which is another high holiday, Jewish holiday, and it's all about housing. Like that's the framing anyway, so it's kind of perfect. But we created it so that it would be both a holiday for members of the Jewish community as sort of like a meaningful way to observe Sukkot and tie it into social justice values, but also for people who were not Jewish or didn't know what the holiday was or anything in between could still come and learn a little bit about it. And then the panel was on right to counsel, so that was that had like the council the city council president who's sponsoring the legislation and people who are actually like drafting the bill and our coalition partners. So we're able to sort of like lift up the spirit and the framing of the holiday and then lead it to the work that we're doing today and what's actually happening now in our city. And again, made it more accessible for people who otherwise would be like, well, I don't want to go to a, you know, I don't really know this organization, or I can't attend physically, or, you know, all of the different ways, making it easier for people to just sort of pop on and learn about what's going on.
So what was the name of the first holiday that was celebrated?
I think it was, I said Rosh Hashanah. It's our,
I think it was the one before that.
The one in August?
Okay, so it's Tisha B'Av, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. Which one was it?
It was the first one.
Okay, Tisha, do you want me to spell it?
Yeah.
So it's Tisha B'Av, so T-I-S-H-A, space, B, apostrophe, A-V.
Thanks.
And Av is like a month, so it's, I don't know what, I should know what it means, but it's like of that month. I'm just going to look it up real quick because if this is being recorded.
So does this like occur in like summertime?
Yeah. So it is, the ninth day of Av. Duh. Okay. That's what it means. So it's the ninth day of Av, which is, which answers your question. It's the Jewish calendar. So it's the, or the Hebrew calendar. So it's falls on that day every year, but we don't exactly follow the Hebrew calendar doesn't line up perfectly with like the calendar that we use, which is why like if you have any Jewish friends, like Hanukkah is always a little different. Sometimes it's like end of November, sometimes it's like mid-December. It's always the same on the Hebrew calendar, but because we don't follow that, it falls differently on like the calendar that we use. So Tisha B'Av this year was, yeah, I think it was early August. I think next year it's like mid-July. So it's like roughly mid-July, mid-August is like the time period it would be.
So sort of dovetailing on that, are there new kinds of celebrations that have happened in the wake of COVID? Or maybe perhaps it's things that have been done before but are done in a new way because of social distancing?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of things are new because of social distancing. One way, and this is something we're definitely still navigating, is how to show up for different hearings because they're virtual. And so not even how can you provide testimony, how can we make sure our leaders can, you know, share their opinion and advocate for themselves and their community members. But one way that we organize and we advocate is like literally showing up into a, you know, a city council meeting with 10 JFJers all wearing blue shirts or all carrying a sign that says whatever the thing is. And we can't do that. And we won't be able to do that also for the state session that's starting in January. So, but it is something, it is an organizing tool, an organizing tactic, and also something that some of our leaders like really appreciate. Because there is also that sense of community and like camaraderie with it. So we're still in the process of figuring that out. But I think something that will come out is like social media campaigns. Like last year at the end of state session, it was like end of March. So we were already in the beginning of the pandemic. And so we had a virtual walking the halls of like the General Assembly buildings where we had like pictures of JFJ leaders with, you know, like the same hashtag and, you know, whatever the ask was at the time. So we're probably going to do things similar, like JFJers are here showing their support for whatever. But of course, it'll be virtual. So I think leaning on things like that to sort of like tweak and revamp things that we've done in the past is definitely something that we'll be doing. And I mean, we're sort of having to reimagine events, both things that we've done every year. So any sort of annual or anything reoccurring has to be reimagined. But then also it is allowing us that time to think about like, is there something missing? So I think I talked last time, although I could be wrong about, you know, one thing that's missing is like before or after meetings, people just like chatting, right? And being like, being able to check in with each other and like, you don't really have that anymore. So realizing that that's missing and is that something that's important? And if it is for building community, then figuring out ways to build it into either that pre-existing work or some other space. And then similarly, you know, like it was never really an issue, people feeling burned out on Zoom or screens. So now figuring out other ways that we might need to create opportunities for connection that are maybe not just staring at a Zoom screen for an hour. But yeah, definitely trying to be creative and also just take advantage of the fact that now there aren't physical borders or jurisdictions that we need to pay attention to. You know, we have our statewide kickoff coming up that was always in a spot sort of in between Montgomery County and Baltimore where like our main leaders were, but of course there's leaders all around Maryland and now it's virtual. So in that sense, it makes it easier for people who wouldn't have been able to make that trek, be able to connect and plug into JUFJ. But then of course, on the flip side, it's virtually accessible, but for some folks that's less accessible if you have any disabilities related to that. So also working to make sure people are included in that space. So both new challenges and new opportunities to connect with other people.
I have a question. Do you think social media has kind of like also helped build community? Because I know like some people post like stuff that their organization is doing on like social media to like connect with like, you know, other people.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can be, but I think it's important not to rely on that. I mean, I think fundamentally it just depends on who your base is. And our base, we're really multi-generational and we have people from, like I said, people who are across Maryland and we also have a DC chapter as well. And so I think social media can certainly be great as a way to amplify our voice, but also the voices of our coalition partners in particular. And also is useful to either, to hold our legislators accountable. A lot of them are really, they pay attention to their social media. So that's certainly an avenue. But on the other hand, there's a bunch of leaders who are just not at all on any kind of social media or on Facebook and not on Twitter. But right now this thing is happening on Twitter or whatever the case may be. So I certainly think it's a place to build to build community, but for us, it I don't think will ever be the place to build community. But I think it's sort of, I'm not sure we will ever have like one singular place. Like there are people who love email and there are people who never check it, right? There are people who like are really would love to have weekly meetings on this topic and other people who really just want to find, you know what I mean? So I think part of it is the definition of community is different for different people, and how people choose and how people can be connected is different. So I think we do need to be more creative with social media and think about other tools, but I don't think it'll ever be like the form that that we use for community.
This feels like such an important point. In one of my classes, we were talking this week about the efforts of the Apache stronghold of the San Carlos Apache and their efforts to protect a sacred place called the Oak Flat. And we're looking at the ways in which social media became this central part of the movement to protect this site, but it was not the only. Mm. It was not the only strategy. So the social media campaign went alongside on-the-ground action and action within various kinds of bodies to pass legislation. And I just want to highlight what you're saying, because I think this is a really important point that I anticipate that various organizations will continue to have to think really critically about. That social media and digital technology offer all of these opportunities, particularly in this moment, to organize and to build community. And who are we leaving out when right. we're thinking about these things, right? Who has access or even knows how to use all of these things and right. who doesn't? And what I'm thinking about is how in some ways this can become very generational, right? Mm-hmm. That a particular generational demographic that knows how to do all these things, that is very savvy, but then who is left out in the process?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think also just, it's also something that I think you want to make sure, I think it's important what the goal is, right? So I think that if it is to raise awareness, then, you know, sure, I think it can be a tool. But if it's really to lead people to action, I think there's only so much you can do from your phone. And I'm not at all saying that you can't do a lot on your phone. You can, especially if, you know, if you have a lot of followers, like you can really amplify messages. You can certainly send emails, call, you can do a lot. But at the end of the day, exactly what you were saying, there's people on the ground doing the work in a lot of different campaigns, literally putting their bodies on the line. And depending on what the goal is, like maybe they really are working with or against, you know, depending like legislators to get something actually through a body. And so I think it's how much of it is just like amplifying and spreading the word, and spreading the word can include and, you know, and email your legislator, and how much of it is about like people on the ground connecting with other people. Because I think as long as it's sort of going in tandem, then it's great. And you just don't want to ever, I think that it can be harmful when it goes into, that's the only thing that it is, right? Like if it's just saying a message for the sake of the message, maybe it's a good message, but it's probably less likely it's going to lead to anything more of like a systemic change. If it's only, you know, a hashtag and that's it. And it still might lead to something, but I think it would have less of an impact if it's not tied to a bigger thing.
Ariel, I'm going to toss it to you if you have a question.
Sorry, I had to finish up writing this. Okay. Let me go back and see. Okay, so. Okay, I guess I'll bring up the conversation from last time and relate it to this time, because you brought it up again about how Zoom, like how, I don't want to say small talk isn't really like happening, but like, you know, the check-ins, like, oh, hi, how are you doing? you know, has that like changed since the last time we talked, or is that like still kind of like going on where it's like, oh, jumping right into the conversation?
I don't know if it's changed since the last time we talked, but well, maybe, I guess yes and no. Like I do think, so we did build in, I can't remember if I shared, like on these monthly statewide calls, we build in an extra half an hour ahead of time that if it's an opt-in, so that if you want to join for 30 minutes of schmoozing, you can. And if you do, if you don't, you can just join at 8 and get the updates. But the other thing that like I've started doing in some of my meetings is having a rounds question. And it used to be having a rounds question that we would all be together and, you know, answer. So it's like, how are we doing? Or what's a one word to describe, you know, something like that. But now I've done it where I have like just randomized small breakout groups of like 3 to 4 people. And they're answering the same question. But now because it's 3 to 4 people, they can get a little bit more intimate, a little bit more detailed, and probably have in those, you know, 5 minutes of breakout time, like a minute or two to have that just like casual conversation. And then it's randomized each time so that you are going to get different people. So that's something that I found people have really appreciated, and it's pretty, you know, pretty easy to set up and pretty easy to participate in. But still does allow for that and is like pretty minimal sort of opt-in. Yeah. And I think also just like internally, I've felt like we've been taking more time to just check in. I think especially because there's just so much going on, and JUFJ really does rely on relationships as like a fundamental aspect of organizing, that I think, you know, being encouraged to sort of like lean into that as part of our conversations. So I feel like that's happening a little bit more internally and just a little bit more as like part of the process. Maybe because we're so many months into the pandemic, maybe because things are bad and the elections are coming up, you know, to just like, yeah, connect with someone on a more like human level before then talking about whatever the thing is that you're talking about. So I feel like it's a work in progress, but I feel like we're all aware of it and kind of, yeah, getting it from different angles.
And it seems like from what you've talked to us in this session, the kind of virtual programming and then kind of the modes of meeting through Zoom across these different distances has been successful and people have been getting things done. And so I'm curious what sorts of things that have started in the pandemic that you think will continue on once we no longer have to engage in social distancing.
Yeah. I mean, certainly I think that I have found meetings to be more, and meetings and any, like whether it's community or more internal, to be more focused. I think time has felt more, like has felt even more important. So I think being like, we are going to meet for 30 minutes on this and that, which I think is something that has always been sort of like a good example of how to have efficient meetings, but is sometimes harder to follow when you're in person and you also want to chat for 10 minutes about like their new dog or whatever. And so even if you do that on Zoom, it's probably going to be a little bit shorter, but I think just knowing that everyone, like giving everyone space to be human, which I think means like having a little bit of check-in time, but also means, okay, I know that when I'm about to have this call with Ariel and Abel, like this isn't the only call they've had today. And like, they're human beings who like get tired and get fresh, you know, whatever. And like, so also giving that space, I feel like that's something that I don't want to say wasn't happening before we did social distancing, but I just feel like is a little bit more underscored now of like, you know, if you have the time, like it's okay. And, you know, even like socially, right? Like if you don't want to hang out this week, cause you know, that's fine. Like giving people space. And so I think, and I hope that some of those sentiments might stay post pandemic. And I'm also hoping like that, I think being able to then like be more discreet about what is in person and what can be virtual, because I think there's certainly a bunch of meetings that I've, you know, that are like a 30-minute drive for everyone so that we can meet in one place. And I think there's a benefit to meeting all together, but maybe it doesn't have to be every week or every other week. It's like that, right? Maybe it's like once a month we all get together in person and it's slightly longer. But now that we've seen the benefit of, you know, being able to stay home and still have a productive meeting. So I think also being able to like discern when is it important to be in person, and therefore like what is it about being in person that is special and that does make you feel more connected to someone. So yeah, I think maybe thinking a little bit more about that and just the value of in person and the value of not in person, and like to kind of get behind what is the goal of what we're trying to do.
And so a follow-up to that, I'm wondering if there are like specific kinds of events or programs that have happened virtually that you anticipate would likely or potentially happen virtually in the mm-hmm. future, post-pandemic.
I think some of our, like, for example, I facilitate our like local team, the Baltimore Action Team, which helps us on our like local campaign work made up of leaders. And we used to always meet in person. And now of course we're meeting virtually. I think that's an example of something that might be one of those once a month, once every 2 months, we meet in person and have a slightly longer event, but otherwise maybe we can at least half the time do it virtually, because there's just so much extra time that goes into it when you're doing it in person that I don't always think you're getting the enough benefit to do. But then conversely, like this year we're having meetings with all of our legislators before the session starts, like with JUFJ constituents in different state districts. And that's all virtual. And I think in some ways that makes it easier for people to attend, easier to have all the legislators sort of in one place. But on the other hand, they used to be at people's houses. And then you'd like meet your legislators and you would have a little bit of that schmooze time that I think the legislators like too, because they're meeting their constituents. And I think that was really valuable. So that's something that even though there are certainly some benefits to doing it virtually now, I think when we can do things in person again is an example of something that I think like is worth that extra time to just make it more meaningful.
So it sounds like there are benefits to just meeting on Zoom, so people don't have to like, you know, drive like 30, 40 minutes to meet in one place for like maybe an hour.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also I was thinking about this today, like working from home, I feel like I'm eating like 3 meals a day. Like when I was working, going from one place to another, like you're maybe going to get food on the, like, as you're going or whatever, but you're kind of much more doing things based on your schedule. And so I think not necessarily that, you know, 100% of organizations are like going to go full remote after this or anything like that, but there are clearly like personal advantages to having more things remotely, even if it's just, great, I'm going to take this call and go for a walk because otherwise I'm not going to be outside at all today. Things like that, that like wouldn't have necessarily or did not occur to me very often when everything was in person, nor did I have that opportunity very often because normally you weren't on the phone, you were in person. So I think there are certainly advantages to having things be remote. I mean, I think the problem is like when things are in excess one way or another, whether it's like everything is in person and so now you're driving everywhere and have no time for yourself versus now you're always on the computer and 12 hours a day staring at a screen and like what's the healthy balance and what is something that is also realistic balance that that we could kind of adapt to, which I think is sort of what we're sort of experiencing, like, okay, this is worth it. This makes sense to do virtually. This is easier for me to attend. versus like, yeah, it's just really not the same, and you know, not doing it in person, or when we did it in this one spot, it was really easy for us to do this, and now it's hard. And again, questions of accessibility, like pros and cons on both sides.
It reminds me too of the idea that, like, so many people I know are working the same, if not more, mm-hmm. when virtual. And so I'm just thinking about our conversation the last time around the importance of rest mm-hmm. in all of this, and how I would anticipate that for folks who are doing organizing work, that even in the midst of things going virtual, folks can still be overworking and burn out and experience exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And so this piece, we talked with someone who also was speaking about the importance of rest. And when we talked with you, the last time, you mentioned about how that is even kind of built into kind of the Jewish framework of mm-hmm. of Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I was talking about this with my supervisor the other day about how I was like, we were talking about rest, and I was saying how we were doing this new check-in where it's like, how are you feeling mentally? How are you feeling physically, Harry? And one of the words was spiritually. And I was like, I've never even had this question before. I don't know how to answer. And basically, as we started talking, I was like, oh, okay, actually, spiritually, I don't feel great. Like, I feel like my soul is like somewhere over there. And like, I'm over here in my body, but like not connected. And I was saying, you know, that I used to try to like, just log on to various like Shabbat services virtually and just like tune in. And even if I like didn't know all this stuff, just sort of have it as like a marker of like, now it's Shabbat, now it's rest, now it's the weekend. And she said, like, even when she was like, yeah, even if I just light candles, like I don't say anything, I don't go anywhere, I just feel this sense of relief that it's Shabbat. And as soon as she said that, I realized like, that's what I'm missing, is like when I go into the weekend and I just like close my laptop and like, or honestly close a tab and open another tab and go to Netflix, like you're not getting that closure. You're not getting that relief. You're sort of just like, okay, now I'm gonna like watch this thing. At least for me, because I used to feel like that relief that I did used to feel by having it be like a marker is gone now. And so I think there is something about, and so part of that is just, I need to figure out what the routine is for me. If it's just, I light candles and do nothing else. If it is, I listen to this one song that is like, great, Shabbat. But another thing is that like, when we were in the office Friday, like we'd start to kind of wrap up because, you know, you have to be done by Shabbat. So especially in the winter, you're like frantically trying to get out the last email because the sun sets at like noon. And then it does feel like a marker, like, okay, we're gone. Like whatever is done is done. It's harder to feel when you just close a tab and then you're like, okay, now I'm entering rest mode. Like you don't even physically go from one place to another. And so especially when you're working in a place that you do also rest, even if you're not working in your bedroom, I think it's hard to have that like delineation. So I think, yeah, even more now, it's really important to try to find that separation. And I think also a lot of the ways that I do rest is like screen stuff, like watching TV or playing a game, like something that is also on my screen. And so I think part of it is also like, what other ways do I need to rest that I normally don't have to think about quite as often? Like, would going on a hike actually rejuvenate me in a different way, or reading or drawing or something like that? So I think it's also starting to raise the question of like, what is rest and rejuvenation beyond like literally sleeping? Because I think some of our normal, at least for me, some of my normal go-tos are not giving me the same sense because, yeah, I'm zoning out watching this show, but my eyes are going to like fall out of my head. And so figuring out different ways to like really replenish your body beyond just like taking an immediate break, if that makes sense. So I think that's what I would say about about Chabot that I really appreciate, that it's built in, but now it relies a little bit more on like me to build that in. So I have to still figure that out.
I feel the same. I'm like trying to find new ways to like rest my brain, because watching Netflix is not helping right now. Like I'm still tired, like all the time.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I think it's like broadening the definition of like what is rest, and also just challenging like what normal rest for me is. Like that's not cutting it right now. And I mean, I think also it's because we are kind of like in a crisis. And so it's not just, okay, I've been staring at a screen, so now I'm still going to stare at a screen. And so that makes sense that I'm not feeling rested. It's also like, I think in a lot of ways we need a deeper rest than, and like, just like, I don't even know what the word is, then we might have, I mean, we've been in crisis for a year, like, you know, 5 years ago, let's say, you know, we might've been able to just like watch an episode of something and felt good. And now like there's many reasons that that's not cutting it anymore. And so I think thinking about not just rest physically, but also spiritually, intellectually, emotionally, all of those things are even more important now.
So on a totally different note, I'm wondering if you could talk about how you would rate your local government's response to the coronavirus.
So that's a hard one. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's been good. I think that generally things were like closed when they should have been closed. And I think people adhered to that. I think that a lot of council members were like fully understanding of the challenges and were even more sort of like doors open policy in terms of like helping their constituents. I think that I guess it doesn't matter what I say, right? Like I could like, this is all C3, so it's fine. I'm just like scared it's recorded and I'm going to be like talking bad about administration. But I do think that the mayor has not been doing a very good job of addressing people's needs related to the pandemic, especially as it relates to like financial concerns. So like, for example, he did, to his credit, he voted for this before the pandemic happened, but he voted alongside members of the Board of Estimates to have a 10% water rate increase that just went into effect like a month or two ago. And I don't know, I can't remember now if he would have had the authority to delay it. I think we did. Like he would have been able to delay that rate hike. Especially I think, you know, due to like extraneous circumstances, there's like kind of extra responsibility that you can have with that. But then also he just announced a plan to privatize our water billing system. So like the way that the company who installed our water meters, which is how you get your bill read, they installed many of them wrong, which is why a lot of people have incorrect water bills. And then Department of Public Works employees were, you know, trained on how to read them and like all of the things. And then he announced that by privatizing it, then the same, and he's going to privatize it with the same company who installed those water meters. So the same people who installed it incorrectly are now going to be in charge. And that also results in 63 Department of Public Works employees being let go. So I just feel like that's a good example of not really being in tune with the financial ramifications of the crisis, and also thinking of things that are going to have long-term implications. It's not just, okay, I mean, I don't even know how you could sort of minimize it, even if it was, oh, only 63 people and that's it. Like that in and of itself is hugely problematic. But even beyond that, like how widespread those ramifications are going to go in Baltimore. So I would say like having that kind of mindset, I don't think the administration has really done a great job from that perspective.
I just can't believe that they installed like the water readers like wrong. Like,
yeah. And yeah, exactly. And we also, I mean, so we work in a Right to Water Coalition and passed the Water Accountability and Equity Act last year that will amongst like one thing is making water more affordable, like capping your water rates. It also creates a dispute resolution process, because right now, like if you get an incorrect water bill, there's like not really an option to dispute it. Whether it's incorrect or not, like if you think it's wrong, there's like not really a mechanism. And especially because so many bills are wrong, it's like really doesn't leave you any recourse. And so we passed it and, you know, the mayor did sign it, all of that. And then it was going to be, the timeline has been like pushed back. And so we just, with the council president as a sponsor again, sort of codified and explained the Water Accountability and Equity Act, including like timeline benchmarks, so that it can actually be implemented, so that especially some of these problems around affordability and transparency about why is my water bill so high can actually take effect instead of just be a bill that then doesn't actually be implemented. And so that's another thing that now we're working with city council to make sure it passes, since otherwise it really nothing has happened from the administration on that.
So now we come to the interview where I have a question that is of a sensitive nature. So I just want to preface that and just say, you know, please feel free to pass if for whatever reason you choose not to or are comfortable to answer. But one of the questions that we've asked our organizations is how the organizations are helping members deal with loss and to what extent. And so if you'd be willing to talk about how the organization is helping members deal with loss in this time.
Yeah, so it's very timely you ask that, because there was a really prominent member of the Baltimore community at large, Baltimore like social justice community at large, passed away, I think, 2 weeks ago, and was really close to people at JUFJ, as well as a lot of our coalition partners, and was like a coalition partner in one of our spaces. And so that like really hit our like broader community pretty hard. And we, JFJ, did a few things. We spent, so she passed away on Sunday, and then on Monday we have our Maryland team meeting, and we just spent the entire meeting talking about her, and then basically a prompt of like who has like inspired you, and because it was also this person who really has been quite a, like an inspirational leader. And it was a very like emotional conversation, but it was really, really nice, and otherwise like wouldn't have had that opportunity to connect. And then same when we had our actual coalition meeting, and the coalition that the woman who passed away was part of, it was the same, where the entire meeting was just reflecting on her and what she taught us, and sort of just like how we're feeling in the moment. And again, it was really, really vulnerable, and that wasn't just a Jewish space, but people were really just sharing where they were. And so I think the whole week it was just very like inward looking, and also just I don't know, it was like felt in every space that I was in. And we also like put a tribute for her both on social media and in our email newsletter. And and honestly, I think sort of gave me and others like an impetus to like get to know each other better and like kind of carry the mantle. But in past times, one thing is, when someone dies, generally in Jewish tradition, you like sit with the body for like 7 days. And, so one way that oftentimes people can show up is to like go there for some of the time and like be with the family and things and sort of similarly like that. So I think if there weren't social distance parameters, I mean, she wasn't Jewish, so I don't think this would have happened with her anyway, but if there were other opportunities to do things like for the family, but especially if it is, someone from Jewish background that dies, then I think that would also be something that, we would do and maybe just like sort of organize like internally of some people who are doing that. But that's also something that we would do.
I anticipate that perhaps one of the most difficult things around passing at this time is not being able to see people and touch people.
Right.
And so like a distant relative in my family passed away that I didn't know. And, you know, my parents knew this person, but it's like, they can't go to a funeral and it's, you can't touch your loved ones to like hug them and like, and yeah. you can't do that over Zoom.
Exactly. No. And I think that's really hard. And it's like, you know, it was so hard to see different people like crying and not be able to do anything. I do think in some ways for me, like I'm not that good at being vulnerable. And I think it was easier for me to be vulnerable because there were certainly people I didn't know very well, but I felt like a little bit more like I had space to say what I was feeling and what I needed to say. And one other thing that I'll note is that I think in the beginning of the pandemic, people were especially feeling like, you know, like aware that the way that we understood community was not accessible to us right now. And so I'm sure you all were invited to like a lot of Zoom happy hours and like all of the things that maybe die down a little bit now. So one thing that my family did is, and I don't think would have happened if we were together because, well, it hasn't happened in years past per se, is my uncle passed away years ago. And so on the like anniversary of his death, you're supposed to like say the mourner's kaddish, like a few prayers for that person. And like light a candle. And normally when that happens, like, you know, we might light a candle in my house and I think my cousins maybe like do go to synagogue like on that day, but we don't do anything collectively as a family. But this year, one of my cousins asked if we could like do a Zoom gathering and like say the prayer together. And we did, and it was really meaningful. And it was sort of the same, like we actually were closer and more connected on this than we have in past years, maybe because this was the only option. So that was interesting where like we might've done stuff individually to commemorate him, but we didn't have a tradition of doing it together in person or otherwise. And then this year we did it at least virtually. And I did feel like we marked it, we did it together. It was more of a chance to connect all together. So that was something that came out that I wasn't anticipating that I think was brought more connection than would have otherwise. It's weird.
Well, and I'm curious, what about like mental health among, I'm trying to remember the acronym, Jews United for Justice people. it's like J-U-F-J?
J-U-F-J, yeah.
So how are folks, how is the organization kind of addressing mental health concerns in this time for folks that are involved in the org?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, like our framing, especially, I mean, that really permeates through most things, but especially when we're talking about how are we doing or what this moment means, is really about taking care of ourselves. And especially from a staff perspective, I think that when you're engaged in any sort of social justice work, it always feels like we feel sort of guilty taking any time for, or I'll just speak for myself. Like, I feel guilty taking time for myself because like I feel like when I clock out or whatever, like I could do more and that more could like actually be helping someone. Right. And I think one thing that we say at JFJ, and especially I think we need to like keep saying, is that if we don't do what we need to do, then like this is a long term, this is like a lifelong process, right? And so we're not just trying to like win this one thing and move on. And so that means like being able to actually be fueled to do the work. And I think that making sure we're continuously framing that, not just for anything internal, but like all of the external things that we do for our leaders and really like in general for anyone, I think has been including that message more, because I think now there is so much uncertainty. And so you can kind of assume that everyone is feeling some kind of way. And so if that's the case, let's at least acknowledge that and like acknowledge people's humanity and say, you know, one thing I always say when I like have a one-to-one with a new person is like, I want you to know that like, you're welcome to get involved as much or as little as you want. And you can change that at any time. Time because like you're a person and you have your own things going on, and at any point things can change. And so you're not going to be like kicked out of JUFJ if all of a sudden you have to stop coming to these meetings for a while, and you're going to be as included if all you do is, you know, check the emails once in a while as if you show up to every meeting. And I think that's really that's really important, because I think it's hard to like internalize that, because I think so much of the work is, especially at JUFJ, like it does highlight the different privileges that we do have. And I think therefore it's, you know, you want to be able to rate, like bring other people up and sort of like amplify other people's voices and power. And then if you're like, whenever you're not doing that, it can be easy to be aware that you're not doing that. But I think focusing on the fact that this is like a lifetime process and we are working for things like for a better future, like for a broader vision, that's not just as soon as this election's over, then we're, you know, like there's not like a stopping point. We certainly have goals along the way. We have different things, different campaigns that we're like imagining, but like it's not like JFJ is only working until 2022 and then like we're out. So I think that's just really important to keep reminding people. And I think our messaging has included that more and more, because there's just so much ups and downs. There are wins that we're having and there's also losses that we're having. And I think it's important to be real about that. And then, you know, hopefully be able to shift some of that anxiety to hope through like reimagining how the future can look and provide people like a path to seeing that future.
The sense that it's a sprint, not a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm curious if you could talk about, this might be in reference to members of the organization or with the sort of partners that you work with. What resources do your members or your partner organizations need to help with to help them cope with the effects of coronavirus?
I mean, I think in the beginning, there was a lot of energy around like direct response. I know that a lot of neighborhood associations were really getting activated and creating like phone trees and lists and making sure people had, like, literally, you know, like had their groceries, had what they needed. And that was a place that was, we're not a direct service organization, but I think there wasn't like a real, like we don't want to not be getting involved if that's the thing, but at the same time, that's not what we're set up to do. And so I think that was an opportunity for more like leadership development and being able to like support the people who were doing that work rather than like directly take that on ourselves. And so I think conversely, like there's other organizations that we work with that do more of that. And so I think serving in that case more as like a resource for JFJers who want to be engaged in that rather than trying to replicate that work or taking ownership of that, being like, there's already things happening. They can certainly use your support and here's who you can connect with or here's a listserv you can get on. I think generally our base and probably the bases of like all of our coalition partners are probably pretty, at this point, pretty well educated on like safety and hygiene and all of that surrounding surrounding COVID. And generally, like we still only do things, we rarely do things in person and only do it when it's like, you know, if you're not wearing a mask, you can't attend, you have to be sick, you know, all of that. And then I think otherwise, I think it's more of an abstract sort of what we've been talking about, like, are there congregations like leading a program or something on like how to stay mindful in this time or how to be connected to others, right? So again, it's the same thing of like doing things for our community and with our community. And at the same time, we don't, if it already exists, we don't need to like duplicate it. And rather it's, we're also, it's really important to just like amplify the work of others and support their work and not just do it ourselves. So I think also, especially in this time, like what else are people already doing? What else are people thinking of doing that, you know, broadly fit into our goals and vision? And then can we collaborate? Can we like, you know, encourage, or I guess, can we just support them in any other ways, or at least like get more people to, you know, to what they're doing? So I think it's like, especially as it relates to COVID, like very specifically, I think it's a good opportunity more for us to engage with like our base and other bases to sort of like connect each other and amplify the work that's already happening.
And as you have been doing this work in the context mm-hmm. of social distancing, how have you or other members of the organization's previous life experience helped to prepare and cope with this moment?
That's a great question. Well, I will say on the election, I wasn't part of any like legit sort of like organization in 2016. And so when we were thinking about any sort of like contingency plans, you know, do we cancel this event? Do we reframe this event? Do we like, what happens if this happens and whatever? I don't have any fallback for like what organizations did in 2016 as it relates to processing. And, but that is something that, you know, others in JFJ have had, and I think that's been really useful in terms of like what is helpful when something nationally happens that feels like, even though we don't do work nationally, feels like we need to address in a more substantial way. So that's something that I think is really useful for people who have not just like been through that, but specifically been through that from an organizational point of view, and if they're in the same type of organization. Trying to think if I have any. Like, I don't even have any example of what the pandemic was like. Oh, it was sort of like in 2010 when I had the flu for a week. Like, I don't even know what to compare it to. So, I mean, I don't think I have any direct things. And I think that was partially, and probably I would imagine for other people, why it was so challenging was like, I learned about myself that I like to be in control of at least certain things. I don't need to be like, you know, but I like knowing my schedule and I like knowing where I'm going to be. And and having some level of assumption around like safety with that. And so not having that was really challenging. I mean, it was good for me to learn that about myself and see like, okay, what can I control in the midst of all this chaos? But I think part of it was that I had literally nothing to fall back on. Normally I feel like when we're in a situation that feels weird or scary, we can be like, okay, well, this is sort of like what happened 5 years ago and I felt the same way, but then this happened. And so that's probably what's going to happen. And I think that also really fueled my anxiety. And I think in general, like, what are we going to point? Like, people keep pointing to the 1918 flu. Like, yes. And that was 100 years ago. And I'm not like, I think it's actually very reassuring when I hear anything about it, but it's also like, that is a lot of times what people refer to. And that just sort of shows how a lot of people like don't have anything to point to at all, that's like the narrative. It's like, well, 100 years ago they did this thing. So yeah, I can't think of anything personal that I've thought of in any point the last 7 months that reminds me of any other time. Yeah.
Well, and in closing, we just wanted to give you space to add anything else that you would like folks to know, either about Jews United for Justice, about Jewish people involved in social justice activism, or about the work that is being done in your local area.
I don't know. I'm probably covered most of it. I think that one thing I'll just say is that I think it's, I know I spoke a little bit about this last time, I think, about like identity of being like white and Jewish and sort of holding both of those roles. And again, not that everyone at JFJ is white and not that everyone at JFJ is even Jewish, but that's certainly like a fair amount of JFJ leaders and even just that's me. And I think that especially things like right now with both the pandemic and the election and all of the other things happening, that role for me or those identities for me are feeling even more like butting heads. Because like I've like had like very serious conversations with my family about like, so at what point do we like literally like leave the US and like go move somewhere because of like feeling unsafe being Jewish. And at the same time, like I have the privilege that, you know, my identity does afford me a lot of privilege that I should maybe stay here and fight for people who have less privilege than me. And like, this is exactly the opportunity that I should stay here for. And I'm not saying we're like, that's happening right now, but the fact that I've like had both of those in my brain, and I imagine other people have too, just even like anyone who has like, I mean, well, everyone has multiple identities, so I imagine a lot of people have. And I just think that is, it was like very surreal even having that conversation with my family and feeling it escalate from like, yeah, it's still really hypothetical, but not quite as hypothetical as it was when we were just casually talking about it 2 years ago or four, you know, or whatever. And so that's like very sobering. And so I think just sort of realizing really where we are and where things could go and how our identity relates to that is something that I've just been thinking about more, especially as it relates to the pressure to keep doing more work, keep doing things for your leaders. And at the same time, like taking that rest and care for yourself and like feeling that tension. So I think that's definitely been like exacerbated right now.
Okay, well, I think we're going to end there, but thank you so much for chatting with us and sharing so much about the work that you and the organization is doing. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.